From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. There's new data on Michigan's biggest COVID hotspots, colleges. Today we're talking about what the latest outbreaks can tell us on how educators are doing containing active cases.
There's not a whole lot of transmission that's being seen in the classroom, even in places that are having a lot of cases. It's really the socializing outside of the classroom where we're most concerned.
Also, one Detroit school takes class outside to dodge the virus.
Pre-K through 8th grade. Everyone is outside, and it's wonderful.
At least until the snow flies, right? Bring some extra gloves and your thermos. And we speak with one of the organizers of Detroit's policing protests about how the game changed this summer.
The police responded in the most brutal way against protesters.
Those stories and more just ahead on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Several Michigan state lawmakers have pushed for a weapons ban after armed protesters crowded into the Capitol building back in April to protest lockdown restrictions. Now, Michigan's Capitol Commission has declined to enact a ban, saying it lacked the authority to do so.
Many of us continue to go into that Capitol building and feel unsafe because there has just been a lack of action on ensuring the safety of the men and women who work there.
We're going to hear later this hour from a state representative who was pushing for the ban. But first, let's turn to the latest public health data. Michigan has a clearer picture today of where COVID hotspots are cropping up. Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services released data on 1,400 cases of COVID across K-12 schools, colleges, and universities yesterday. Given information trickling out of places like Ann Arbor and East Lansing, the news here may not come as a huge surprise, but the data may sharpen the picture for what reopening could or should look like, both at schools and in other places where people gather. For some help with the numbers, we're joined now by Emily Martin, an associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Emily, welcome back to Stateside.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So just to summarize what we know in terms of higher ed, cases on the campus of the University of Michigan and Central Michigan University have been up and down a bit, but haven't shown huge spikes that we know of. Grand Valley State still leads all the other schools with 438 cases. And at Adrian College, at least 10% of its population has the virus. And at Michigan State University, the cases have climbed to such a point where Ingham County's health officials have called for a 14-day quarantine. Were there any surprises in the data that the state made available yesterday?
I think it confirms what I have been sort of surprised by so far, but it sort of makes sense, is what I call the hotspot nature of this virus, is that it doesn't go up everywhere at the same time. You might have big situations taking off in places, and especially in some of these smaller colleges where it's really evident that something's happening. You may see other places that are still calm and not a whole lot happening there. So it's really kind of an uneven pattern that we're seeing in all different parts of the state in terms of who's taking off and who's not.
You know, I feel like I need to qualify the word quarantine. I know that Michigan state officials had called for a quarantine last week, but added that it would be okay for students to continue to go to class if they were meeting face-to-face, to go shopping if they needed to. Do you think that we're at a point where we need a new way of communicating to people what steps are appropriate?
I think that's a good way to put that. And so, you know, because we use the word quarantine for so many different things, when really what we want to do is create more space between us. And you know, what we hear from our colleagues and other colleges around the country is there's not a whole lot of transmission that's being seen in the classroom, even in places that are having a lot of cases. It's really the socializing outside of the classroom where we're most concerned. And so, you know, that's, you call it quarantine, you can call it whatever you want. We just don't want people to gather in big groups, especially in scenarios where you don't have a lot of controls and mitigation measures in place, like you might have in a classroom where the, you know, desks are spread out and you might have face shields or other kind of protections in the room.
What's your impression of how Michigan is doing overall with the availability of tests?
So, you know, there's a lot of tests, and the tests across the state keep going up and up and up, and that's good to see. I know there's a lot of efforts statewide to try to push more tests into the system all over the state. I do think that we're eventually going to get to a point where you know, really, this is a national level issue and a national level supply chain problem we're going to keep running into. And really, you know, I'm pushing more and more for a national level solution for this is what I would like to see us be at eventually.
You know, there are some students at schools that are attached to medical programs like the University of Michigan that have expressed surprise that testing isn't more widely available. We should say this has definitely come up at the University of Michigan, which, by the way, holds Michigan Radio's license and, of course, is your employer. Mm-hmm. Do you have any insight about why universities, especially those that do have medical schools attached to them, have not been able to test more widely or communicate results more clearly?
You know, I think that there's a balance in you know, it's there's a balance between making sure that you are providing clinical, all of the other clinical care needs and providing tests for the different priorities of testing or the tiers of testing, as I call it. And I think medical centers tend to be caught right in the middle of that balance because they have this responsibility to the whole community and all of the other players in the community that need ready access to tests also, nursing homes, prisons, jails, K through 12 schools. And so I think some of this is a reflection of that need to kind of be a member of the wider community and balance that with the needs of testing on campus.
The state also yesterday listed a handful of outbreaks at K through 12 schools. Now, all of them are officially listed at fewer than half a dozen cases. Should we assume that those numbers are representative, or are you concerned that maybe we don't know as much as we might?
So I think it helps to understand how we think about the term outbreak or the term cluster when we're talking about schools. So we're really carefully trying to look for instances where there are cases that we think of that are related to each other and that are related somehow to the school. They had some sort of contact or interaction in that setting. So what it's going to miss is that overall level of cases that are rising in a community is sort of kind of think about it like the high water mark. As the water gets higher, all cases are going to go up. And you may or may not see that reflected in a particular building, for instance. So it is only one piece of the picture.
Are the current stated number of cases at K through 12 schools, are they of concern to you?
It's about what I would expect. Seeing what's in the community around, it does seem to be where it seems like things would be if we've got, you know, we have a fair amount of virus in our communities around the state still. And so it seems to follow with that pattern.
Right. What's on your mind with respect to stabilizing Michigan's situation for the fall? Do you think that people should be more concerned about community spread, or maybe their interactions outside of their home communities that might get the virus moving in places where it hasn't been?
I think that this is a time to be conservative. With our interactions, especially outside of our schools and workplaces. And the reason for that is, you know, I think that we're moving into cold and flu season, which is going to be a really complex and challenging time. And so the lower that we can get community transmission now, while we still have, you know, really only COVID that we're dealing with on our landscape, the better off we'll be as we move into January and February.
We should mention that our guest Emily Martin is like so many people working from home right now and with her canine assistance team there in the background. Emily Martin, should the focus be on the fact that there are new cases cropping up, or should we just not worry too much about the fact that, yes, the virus is here, it is among us, and we should focus on how fast we can get people identified and quarantined if they are positive for COVID?
You know, all of the data I've seen have said that the speed to identify and quarantine people and to do the contact tracing is really the most effective tool that we have. And so making sure we keep our eye on quarantine and isolation is I think, it's really what we need to focus on going forward.
There had been high hopes that Michigan would be able to ramp up contact tracing quickly, both with volunteers and with the health departments who traditionally do this work, and maybe with some additional workers that the state might hire. Do you have any thoughts on how that process has played out in Michigan so far?
I think the numbers I've seen have shown that the capacity has really been building, and it's been building nicely and building in a lot of regions in the state. I think, you know, from what I'm hearing, there's a lot more challenges in working with people that we need to get into contact with in order to do these processes. People need to answer their phone, and people need to help. And it's not a punitive process. It's the goal of contact tracing is to try to help protect the community by making sure that people who are infected aren't moving around in our spaces. And so we really need the community's cooperation with that effort.
At this stage, are you thinking much about the possibility of another winter surge that might have the potential to overwhelm hospitals and other healthcare providers?
I think it's prudent for us to be prepared for that. Just for a winter surge of COVID infections, but the potential of layering those infections on top of what we'll need to do to take care of people with influenza and with other respiratory viruses. So I think it's smart for us to be preparing for that.
No question. I feel like this is one of the unspoken truths that anyone who works in a nursing home or an assisted living facility can actually tell you a lot about. Overall, would you say that infection control among vulnerable populations is where it needs to be?
Absolutely. And, you know, we know that PPE works. So masks work to be able to slow things down. We actually, you know, we see this in our hospitals where people are taking care of patients that are infected every day. And they're doing that by using appropriate PPE. And I think the faster we can get that distributed around the community, the better.
I'm sure the difficulties associated with so many at-risk populations feeling a bit more isolated is another topic for another day.
Absolutely. You know, this is really the time where we need to think about, I've heard some people refer to it as our social distancing budget, our risk budget. And, you know, think about spaces in your life that you might be able to dial back a little bit to allow you the bandwidth and the infection-free time to be able to engage in school and work going into the fall.
Emily Martin is an associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Emily, thanks so much.
Thank you.
When contagious diseases were spreading in American cities in the early 20th century, educators found creative ways to keep children in school. They didn't have computers or video chats. What they did have was outdoor classrooms. Next on Stateside, a Detroit school that's turning to the same solution during the current pandemic.
We want kids to be really comfortable in weather and to be comfortable in this climate. So we will try and stretch it as long as we can, as long as the indicators are saying everyone is still healthy.
That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As parents are powering through the work-school balance during lockdown, it's easy to think wistfully that there has to be another way to do this. And maybe some of that is wishful thinking, but this moment in Michigan education is certainly an opportunity to take a hard look at what isn't working about traditional education and what might be different for our kids, either during the pandemic or for the long term. One school in Detroit is performing a radical experiment this fall, taking its classes all outside. Linda Williams is a seventh grade teacher at Detroit Waldorf School, which serves kindergartners through eighth grade students and which is trying outdoor classes this year. Linda Williams, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Tell me how this idea came up.
Well, like everyone else, we were trying to figure out what we could do to reopen in the fall. It looked like this pandemic was going to persist, and we began looking around for other ideas. And I'll tell you, it was really a group of parents at our small independent school who came together. There are architects among them and planners and designers, and they came up with this project along with some faculty members. Everyone looked at it and said, you know, this is the way we should go. Now, outdoor classrooms are not new, as you probably know through your own research. And actually, when I was studying education in a history of education course, I knew that there were buildings built in Detroit to be open air classrooms back in the early 1900s. Mm. And I always wondered if our school, the Detroit Waldorf School, which was designed by Albert Kahn, if it had had some of that instinct also with all of the windows we have. We have enclosed some areas of the upper floor of the school that used to be a kind of veranda and where children would be able to sit out in the open air. So it wasn't a totally new idea. We just went for it. We set up a GoFundMe and people put in money for it. And we have now 14 outdoor classrooms.
Wow. What grades are trying it? Is there at least one outdoor for all the grades?
Yes, pre-K through eighth grade.
That's amazing.
Everyone is outside. And it's wonderful. This also exists in many places. I'm sure you've heard of outdoor kindergartens and things going on in Europe and in California. And those have been up for about 20 years. And of course, at the same time, we set up our classrooms so that they're socially distanced and that we have as much ventilation as possible. We have fans, we have air filters. And so when we have to come inside, we will be ready to do that.
What's teaching outdoors like for you?
Oh, my goodness. You know, teachers were looking at each other at the end of last week. Usually the first week of school wears us out, getting everyone in place and kids coming off of summer vacation and not quite ready to be enclosed in the classroom. Mm-hmm. This is a perfect segue to the school year. I mean, I'm sure if it gets cold enough or the weather gets inclement, we will have to go inside. But right now, we are extending sort of our summer break into a kind of camp atmosphere. And at the same time, kids are revving up for learning. We just did our whole thing on progressive tenses this morning. And yeah, the kids are really ready to learn.
Grammar in the great outdoors.
Yes. I was thinking one of the things that happens is, one, kids are getting tons of vitamin D, right? When we go from summer and then go indoors, how we just miss just that boost that vitamin D and sunshine give you. So that's one thing that's happening. The children are more relaxed, but focused. I was even surprised, you know, when a booming car goes by or something happens. There's a look maybe, but then the focus returns to whatever we're doing in the classroom. And then there's that feeling that you can step out from your work and go right into recess. So there's no big transition time. All of a sudden, we have badminton rackets out today, and kids are just playing and just having a wonderful time. So it's social like camp, but it's also focused like school. There's a real community village atmosphere when you have your classes kind of all in earshot of each other.
Right.
That has been really wonderful because we can't really just play together at recess. We do keep all the classes in their separate pods. So my kids stretch out, but they're only stretching out with each other. That's something how the community feel really persists, and it's even maybe emphasized outdoors more than it would be indoors.
As a practical matter, I take it kids are going back inside for bathroom breaks. Are there other things that they need to go in for?
We had to come in to get supplies, but now everyone is having everything in their backpacks. But yeah, bathroom breaks, and so you go individually. Now, we have to remember, this is a small school. We have about 200 kids, and so we can be this flexible, and we can have people, you know, crossing guards, extra crossing guards. We hired a nurse this year who's monitoring all of our health, and so we're doing all of the social distancing and health protocols. But, yeah, the best part is that we are outdoors. Our first day was thunder and lightning. We had to come in for a little bit.
Oh, gosh.
But, yeah, but while the pouring rain is there and we're in these shelters, it was just magical.
Is Detroit Waldorf going to do any kind of assessment this year? Or might there be some other indicators that would let you know on the other side how this worked out?
Sure. So, of course, we're monitoring health quite closely, so making sure folks are well. We're also monitoring even allergies and other illnesses that you usually see at this time of year and trying to compare that and see if it improves or is worse. But then academic assessment will continue as always, and so we will see how students are doing, you know, in math and science and social studies. And the artistic work, too, trying to see how this works outside and different ways to do handwork, to do clay modeling, to do drawing and so forth. Yeah, so we are. We're monitoring it quite closely. We meet weekly and we're collecting a lot of data.
I unearthed a photograph from about 1908. It was a picture of kids from Boston bundled up for outdoor school during a tuberculosis epidemic.
Yeah.
They looked pretty frosty. you mentioned that there would be a time, you assume, when kids would have to go inside. But how far into the school year do you think you can keep this going?
Yeah, so if we can do things like add perhaps canvas sides to insulate just a bit, I think that we'll be able to stay out, hopefully, at least through early November. Also, you know, bodies acclimate better to outdoors the more you're outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're so used in our modern world, of course, to run inside or turn up the heat as soon as we jump into the car. But that's another thing we're trying to monitor to see how children's health and their response to cold is. Yes, we don't want everyone, you know, taking off a mitten just to write sentences, their paragraph in perfect sense or something like that. But we want kids to be really comfortable in weather and to be comfortable in this climate. So we will try and stretch it as long as we can, as long as the indicators are saying everyone is still healthy.
Linda Williams teaches 7th grade at Detroit Waldorf. Ms. Williams, thank you so much for talking to us and good luck this year.
Thank you so much. Take care.
The commission that operates Michigan's State Capitol building in Lansing yesterday put off a decision about firearms on Capitol premises after a protest last spring drew noisy and heavily armed observers to the legislature's gallery. Lawmakers from both parties and some Capitol staffers expressed concerns about the status quo. In lieu of a decision, the commission has decided to arrange a meeting with House and Senate leaders to discuss options. Sarah Anthony was one of the lawmakers who spoke out about concerns. She represents the very land where the Capitol lies and the rest of House District 68 in Lansing. Representative Anthony, welcome back to Stateside. How are you holding up?
I'm holding up okay. You know, it's 138 days now since we last had armed gunmen storm the Capitol building without any action from our Capitol Commission. So, you know, frustrated about that issue, but still working hard on other issues. So we have to kind of move forward despite some of the lack of action on that front.
You testified before the state's Capitol Commission, asking them to move forward with plans to try to put some restrictions on carrying at the Capitol. Can you explain what you told them?
Well, you know, I was a little frustrated because by the time I was able to speak, which was during public comment, they had already made the decision not to act during the meeting. They decided that, you know, despite having a, you know, Attorney General's opinion from both Bill Schuette, the former AG, as well as the current Attorney General, Dana Nessel, as well as other legal opinions and studies, that they still did not decide to act on banning firearms in the Capitol. And so I was just frustrated. And I tried to remind them of what happened on April 30th of this year and how many of us continue to go into that Capitol building and feel unsafe because there has just been a lack of action on ensuring the safety of the men and women who work there, as well as, you know, folks who tour the Capitol. Folks have articulated to me, many of whom are my constituents who work in the building, have just said, you know, something has to happen. Something has to happen to ensure our safety in this building. So the inaction of the Capitol Commission was really frustrating yesterday.
This is a case of a supercharged political topic going before a body that would like to see itself as apolitical. Do you think that there are other ways to address the subject of guns in the Capitol building other than leaving it in the hands of the Capitol Commission?
You know, and that's the conflict for me. I don't see this as a political issue. If I had chosen to run for city council in my community and worked in City Hall in Lansing, I would have some sense of safety because when I go into City Hall, there's no guns allowed. If I decided a career in law and was practicing in the Hall of Justice, just a couple minutes away from the state capitol, I feel as though I would be more safe because they don't allow firearms. And yet in this Capitol building, it becomes a political issue. And I don't see, you know, ensuring the safety of the men and women who work in that building as a political issue. And that's what's been so frustrating to me, that it has become political. And this Capitol Commission should not be a political body. It should be a body that governs the operations of a government building. In this case, the building being the state capitol.
You know, since the last time we spoke several months ago, gun ownership and the question of who is allowed to display weapons in public has come into stark relief nationally. There was a couple in St. Louis who pointed guns at Black Lives Matter protesters and subsequently spoke at the Republican National Convention. There was a 17-year-old vigilante with an AR-15 who killed two protesters in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And these were white people who were praised in some conservative circles. The current debate around gun ownership, how do you see it fitting into the other tensions that we're experiencing this year?
You know, we are not in isolation here in Michigan. We are looking at the rise of not just gun ownership, but just violence in general across the nation. And for us to think of ourselves and say, well, nothing will happen in our Capitol building, nothing will happen on the grounds of the Capitol, I just think it's not a matter of if, but when. I believe in the Second Amendment. I'm a gun owner myself. But at the end of the day, this is just common sense, that if we know and we have seen these tensions escalating all across the state, all across the country, it is our responsibility to ensure that a place that brings all these folks together and that these big decisions are made in those halls of the Capitol, that we can at least ensure a safe workplace. This just doesn't seem that difficult. This doesn't seem that hard. And so it's just been frustrating to continue to see the lack of action, despite all of the rising tensions that we're seeing and that you named.
I know that it's not exactly a normal work schedule in Lansing these days, but how do you intend to approach going to work at the Capitol on Second Amendment days as long as guns are allowed in the building?
You know, I mean, I still have a job to do. The people of Lansing hired me to do a job. They hired me to go in to the Capitol and to introduce bills and to fight for bills that reflect their priorities. And I haven't missed a day of work, and I don't plan on doing so moving forward if I can help it. And so if we are scheduled to go into session on Thursday on open carry day, I will plan to be there. I'd prefer not to be there that day, but as I think most people would not want to go into a workplace full of armed gunmen and women. I think that's just a very human way to look at this. But despite that, I have to show up to work and do the job that I was hired to do.
Sarah Anthony, while we have you on the phone, we've got just another minute, and I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about how and if your legislative priorities have shifted this year. We've talked before about your plan to provide college access to Michiganders, and the governor has recently moved the plan forward for providing tuition help for our frontline medical workers. What else is on your mind right now, whether it's that economic recovery through higher education or just the numbers in the Lansing area right now for COVID?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've talked, COVID has shifted everything, but I am still laser focused on workforce development issues, on expanding access to higher education, particularly for folks who, you know, first generation college students, folks who wouldn't have the opportunity to matriculate after high school. I'm still laser focused on that. But we've seen under leadership of this governor that she is also prioritizing expanding opportunities for all. My priorities have continued to be about that as well. So the Future for Frontliners program, I'm one of the legislative champions on that initiative, because I think that COVID has shown many people that a high school diploma just is not enough, and people have been rocked financially, emotionally, you know, after this pandemic. And so I think that my priorities remain the same, of making sure that every Michigander has a path to prosperity. And that has looked like additional training and additional education. And so I'll just continue to fight for that.
How have your day-to-day movements been going in this stage of COVID preparedness and lockdown?
you know, the biggest part of the job that I love is actually interacting with my constituents, meeting with people, you know, going to neighborhood association meetings and churches and synagogues. And it's been difficult to connect with people, but we have made it work. We have done more Zoom calls and virtual town hall meetings, and any way that we can still connect to constituents, we have gotten really creative. But there is nothing like that human touch. And so I hope we get to a point, if everyone continues to mask up and do the things we need to be doing, that hopefully we can transition back to a little bit more normal interaction so that we can actually be together, gather together, and touch one another in a way that, you know, is from a more human perspective. So I hope we can get to that point soon.
Sarah Anthony represents House District 68. Sarah, it's good talking to you. Take care.
It's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you, April.
The group that's led months of protests over police brutality is calling for the resignation of Detroit's police chief, James Craig.
Like, I know every time I see police, you know, I'm much more alert when they're around, on guard, than when they're not. And that says something. That shouldn't be the response of people who are here to protect and serve.
We'll hear from one of the activists pushing for change and what he envisions for the future of policing in the city. That's next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. When protesters took to the streets in Michigan this spring in the names of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and countless other black men and women across the nation killed during police interactions, Detroit was right at the forefront. This was a city all too familiar with the issues at hand. This was a city that remembered the history of 1967, where officers seemed to have less interest in drawing the attention of federal officials. A city that was taking care of its protest business. And then came the night of August 23rd, when the largely peaceful protest ended with a confrontation on Woodward Avenue. Police ordered protesters to disperse. When the crowd stayed put, police beat them, used tear gas, and arrested more than 40 people. And the conversation has changed a lot since that night. Tristan Taylor is an organizer with Detroit Will Breathe, the advocates who've organized months of street action and who are now calling for the resignation of Chief James Craig. Tristan Taylor, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Could you describe what was different the night of August 23rd?
I think what was different the night of August 23rd, actually there were two things. And one of them was the character of the event itself. Which was a really festive event in a whole set of ways. We literally had a DJ playing music for us, like as we took up space on Woodward. And you contrast that with the response of the police to that is a really stark contrast. And what was different about August 22nd was, even though this was a festive and in a lot of ways the most relaxed event, that the police responded in the most brutal way against protesters that we've seen. More than four people ended up in the hospital with serious injuries, countless others, you know, having injuries and wounds.
Chief Craig has sort of cast the police response as a matter of maintaining order. You know, he's invoked what happened in Seattle, where protesters were, you know, sort of in an encampment that was police free for a long time, and saying that that wasn't going to happen here. And he's also said that he has no plans to resign. What do you make of his response?
His response shows the reason why he has to go, because he just seems to be detached from a reality and really tone deaf. In terms of both where the community is at and how it really isn't okay to visit protests against police brutality with police brutality. I just think that it just shows how determined he is to keep business as usual, which means a police department that acts with impunity, where he defends every police officer on the force no matter what they do.
Was there any plan to establish some kind of encampment in Detroit?
No, like we didn't have a single tent. And I just want to note that even the characterization of like Seattle is a mischaracterization. There's a great citizen journalist, I think Amari Salisbury is his name, who like, you know, documented the encampment in Seattle and how like most of the time it was like a festival, but it was an encampment. They had like tents, they had food, they had a whole big setup. Like we had, you know, none of that. We just wanted to be able to take up space to highlight and to show our seriousness around the issues of the Duggan and Craig cooperating with federal agents from the Trump administration.
That's Mayor Mike Duggan of the city of Detroit that you're referring to. Would you say that Detroit will breathe response to this and the demand that Chief Craig resign? Is this more about what happened that night or what has happened since then?
It's a culmination, really. We've been asking, demanding Chief Craig's resignation ever since, I believe the date is June 10th, when police officers ran over protesters protesting in Southwest Detroit with their SUVs. And August 22nd was the last straw for a lot of community groups who weren't signed on previously to the demand that Chief Craig has to resign, but did. And we actually did a press conference where over 35 organizations signed on to the demand that Chief Craig resign. He's just oversaw the police department that acts with impunity. There was a lawsuit by a 70-year-old woman who was arrested last year by DPD, and they caused her to have a seizure because they had the 70-year-old woman, black woman, you know, down on the ground in handcuffs. And he just could, his police officers do no wrong. And that's a problem.
What have interactions with the police been like in some of the actions that have happened since August 23rd?
For the most part, there's been very little police interaction. One of those things is because of the temporary restraining order that we were able to get from a federal judge. The other is an expression of what I think is a deep support of the movement in Detroit, especially when we're marching in neighborhoods. The way that people respond to us, I think that DPD knows if they were to take action against the protesters, that they would be exposing themselves to the community as being unnecessarily hostile to a group of people fighting for the interests of black and brown people throughout the city.
There was an announcement from a city attorney that there would be a countersuit to the federal lawsuit that Detroit Will Breathe and others had filed. Can you bring us up to speed on what else you might have heard about that?
The only thing that, I mean, the problem is this administration, the Duggan administration, says a lot of things that never comes into existence, and one has to wonder if it's serious at all. We haven't heard anything serious about a counter lawsuit. They are trying to amend the temporary restraining order, though.
Right.
But the idea that the city of Detroit's response to a lawsuit around police misconduct and brutality of peaceful protesters is to file a lawsuit against peaceful protesters, I mean, really actually shows how rotten and out of touch this administration is, and how draconian the policies have been over the years in Detroit, to the extent that they would not only stay silent, but actively support police violence and brutality.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tristan Taylor, an organizer with Detroit Will Breathe, the group that has been in the streets calling for justice for people of color in Detroit since this spring. Tristan Taylor, Detroit police have a somewhat unique history among American police department. They underwent years of federal oversight because of a legacy of violence and bigotry. And as a result, it arguably has a higher degree of integration. And it's often called a more functional department than some other cities have, one that's in greater in greater accord with the community that it serves. But I wondered if that's your assessment as well, just comparatively speaking, whether the Detroit Police Department is farther along than some.
Yeah, it's hard to argue that from my experience, and I'm sure there are departments that are worse than Detroit Police Department, and that's really bad because Detroit Police Department is not great. Again, officers act with impunity. In fact, the Board of Police Commissioners, several commissioners have complained about officers with egregious complaints against them being promoted. There's been issues of the police interaction with community, including the fact that most of the time when you call in neighborhoods, regular neighborhoods, not the neighborhoods that are part of the strategic neighborhood planning in the city of Detroit of revitalized neighborhoods, the response time to police is terrible if they show up at all. And the interaction that they have, especially with young people, is just really an interaction of harassment. And so they have no deep community ties. And that is expressed by the way in which, like, you know, regular Detroiters walk with fear whenever police kind of cross. Like, I know every time I see police, you know, I'm much more alert when they're around and on guard than when they're not. And that says something. That shouldn't be the response, right, of people who are here to protect and serve.
Your history of activism goes back to the days of the Occupy movement. And I think you were still in your teens at that point. Could you talk a little bit about what you learned during Occupy and maybe how it's informed, you know, the way that you think about goals or just what you're hoping to do with your time with Detroit Will Breathe right now?
Sure. My experience with Occupy, I learned a lot, and it was something that I view as really impactful, but also from a critical standpoint. One of the things that I was involved with during Occupy was successfully doing an occupation of libraries in Detroit to keep the libraries open from closure. And we did home defense against people facing eviction. So it definitely proved to me the power, you know, of like collective action. I think the one downfall of the Occupy movement was the fact that it didn't have real clear demands and that it didn't see itself as having a dynamic perspective that meant really deeply engaging with issues of like working class Black and brown people in the city. It was able to do that, but not have that work be so much a central figure to it. You know, it tried definitely a lot of things, but I think the you know, lesson to be learned is having demands is really important because it makes it clear what you're trying to do. And it helps you be consistent in doing that too.
The Occupy movement, as you know, was a very different kind of movement. It sprung out of Occupy Wall Street in New York, but in different cities around the country, it came to embody very different things. Like you say, here in Detroit, there were a lot of housing issues at play. They were the Occupy protests in Detroit were kind of notably uneventful comparatively. What would you say is different this time?
This is completely different. And part of it, what is interesting is in each iteration of the kind of social explosions that we're seeing, whether it be Ferguson or, you know, like the one around George Floyd, we see this growing interconnectedness with people across the country, but also around the world. And I think what's different between Occupy and this is, one, the character of the issues, that the issue of police brutality and the issue of racism is so central to this recent uprising in the way that it wasn't during Occupy, that it meant Black and brown communities were able to play a more central role in this struggle. And what's interesting about this recent iteration of like mass revolt is the way in which it has been able to pull huge sections of the population. So it's a really integrated movement, but that's challenging the most formidable issue in the United States, which is racism.
Mm-hmm. There are many who have noted that the character and composition of this movement is very different than Occupy and some other recent protests in a lot of ways. It could be said that some of the white people who got involved in the protests, you know, there was consternation among some activists and black leaders because of the mode or the message that white activists had delivered. And that was true across the country as well as here in Michigan. But would you say that there has been some progress made in terms of allyship, or are you still sort of waiting to see the outcome of the movement?
No, I think there's been great progress. And again, the difference between Occupy, right, and this movement around police brutality is the way in which black and brown voices have been able to play a central role, right? And the fact that there are large groups of people prepared to take the leadership of those black and brown voices shows that there is a lot of progress and a lot of people who are seeing that what it means to be an ally, which I actually don't like the word. You know, I need a co-conspirator. That's what I say. So, but having people who are prepared to come out and actually put their bodies on the line to show like their support against police brutality and systemic racism, I think is something that's like really important. And, you know, we got struggles to go. We live in a hyper segregated and stratified country, and especially in Michigan. So there's a lot of gaps that have to be bridged, a lot of experiences that have to be translated and learned. But I think we're doing a really good job of that, because the fact that this movement is still alive shows me that the power and the commitment and the depth of understanding that you need to survive 100 days is strong enough and clear enough that people are, you know, still coming out.
I've heard you quote Martin Luther King Jr. before, saying that, I'm going to paraphrase this probably poorly, saying that power isn't when someone says yes to you. It's when they want to say no, and yet they are compelled to say yes. How do you envision that kind of power right now? Is it the duration of the protests in the street, the numbers of people there, or some mix of those factors?
Yeah, it's a combination of those factors. And, you know, I'll just point out that there's so many things that this movement across the country has been able to achieve in the past 100 days is really like a big culture shift. We've seen, you know, substantive changes, not just around like policing. We've seen departments across the country actually be defunded. Like, we've seen more accountability. And I think that's because all of this energy, the movement has been able to make use of the energy, focusing it in various channels. And in Detroit, one of the things I think about is the Bill of Rights that was put forward by Councilwomen Sheffield and Lopez to enshrine in the city charter a set of like rights, not only around police accountability, but around water, making sure that neighborhoods are correctly funded, that there's a certain percentage that they have to be funded to make sure that, you know, we provide like stable living conditions for people in Detroit. The contract around facial recognition, or the DataWorks contract, city council didn't vote to get rid of that contract, but they also didn't vote to extend it either before they went to recess. And so that's an expression to me of the kind of power of the movement to really force officials to do something or stop them from doing something that they otherwise would have done.
Tristan Taylor is an organizer with Detroit Will Breathe. Tristan, thanks for talking to us, and stay safe out there.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it.
We've extended several invitations to the Detroit Police Department to come on the show and talk about the protests and claims from Detroit Will Breathe. We will have Chief Craig or another representative on from the department when and if they accept the request. And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. I'm April Baer. We'll see you tomorrow.